just cast your mind back to the government conference. A lot of announcements were made throughout. Are there any standout points that really caught your attention?
Yeah, one thing I'm really thrilled about is to see the government take account of some of the measures that we've pushed forward. And one of the things we've been pushing for the past few years quite hard is the policy on zero ratings. So there's a lot of property, if it's derelict, if it's falling apart, if it's not being used productively because it can't be used, then we essentially give a giant tax cut to these properties paid for by all of the ratepayers. And we've been fighting hard to get that done. And it's really great to see the sort of that announcement from the government that that is going to become key to government policy. You see a lot of really good energy in the government conference, but one thing that you don't see is a lot of tangible steps to sort of make use of the resources that we have to get things done. Sort of unsure at times where the government is exactly wanting to go and how they want to achieve it, and trying to scramble something together in the sort of last year of the administration. And it just feels as though there's a lot of time that's been wasted. We've been fighting to get our housing plans action for the past half a decade now. And if they'd come to us with this energy back then, we probably would have had cleared huge chunks of our housing waiting list by this point now.
We'll touch on a lot of those points that you've just mentioned, but how much of what government announces in the conference are things that you have to take back to Douglas City Council and start to plan for, or maybe not necessarily find ways of fitting in, but maybe adopt new ways of thinking?
So one thing that we have found, and this is one of the things that sort of drives forward our administration, is that Douglas has always been a sort of government within a government. So when you look at like a lot of progress that's happened on the Isle of Man, whether it has been establishing democracy, building public transport for the very first time, establishing sewer lines or electricity supply, all of these things came from the council first and then were later adopted by central government. And what council exists to do is push forward in certain areas, and then hopefully government sort of is willing to sort of work with us or meet us halfway or align with us as time sort of moves on. And that's why we try to have quite a forward-facing sort of waste policy plan. A small island, we should be recycling a lot more than we currently do. It's shameful that we do have some of the lowest recycling rates in Western Europe, and that's something that we have been finding to sort of implement an intelligent waste strategy. We are the only entity on the island that recycles en masse. And the same thing with housing. We've got a forward-thinking housing plan of where do we want to be in 10 years from now. And it's less us planning for what government has to do, and more sort of sometimes it feels like waiting for government to catch up.
And what would you say are the government's biggest challenges as we go into these final 12 months?
I mean, I think I sympathise with a lot of the challenges government has. So I think that the public is very aware of tax rises, but there are also incredible stresses on public services. So healthcare is a huge issue. Lack of housing is a huge issue. And I suppose it's one of those in which what we suffer from is a crisis of imagination. And government wants to do stuff, but I don't think that it knows exactly how to go about doing that. And that's probably because you've got a parliamentary system that doesn't have any party politics. So it's very difficult to get a coherent sort of ideological direction on where to go. But I also think that we've got this fundamental problem as a society where we're afraid of trying things that are new unless they've been done in the UK. And sometimes it just feels as though we're waiting for the UK to belatedly do something and then kind of copy off their homework. I mean, if a policy has been tested or works in a place like Finland, Estonia, Norway, Denmark, France, Germany, or even, God forbid, the United States, we can't adopt those policies unless we get someone here to sort of get a sort of UK-ified version of that.
I mean, realistically, the sitting keys don't really have 12 months. They only have maybe half a year at best because of obviously the no big decisions can be made in the final months once Keys is dissolved. Are you basically saying that there needs to be more out-the-box radical thinking and a willingness to try things and see what sticks?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's both looking backward and also looking forward, right? So I think that what we've seen is a lot of backlash, particularly on immigration targets. And I think that it's one of those in which we've, to some extent, maybe the backlash was related around chasing a sort of arbitrary number rather than going for what skills do we need to have filled, and then filling those specific skills, and how do we train people to fill those skills, and how do we bring people to sort of replace some of the folks that have moved away, which is essential to sort of maintain a population balance. But I think what I mean in this answer in general and in a sort of in a nutshell is that there is, I'm not sure how much the government can do now in the next 12 months, but I suppose that is a problem of our system, right? Like, if in the first 2 years of government, government can't do anything because it's still finding its feet, and in the last year of that administration, it can't really do anything because it's winding down, then out of every 5 years, there's maybe 2 years where stuff can be done, and a lot of that is holdovers from previous administration. And that's not to say there hasn't been like a lot of really good work the government has done over the past few years, but it's just a problem with the way our political system is configured at the moment.
Let's turn our attention to housing, one of the key topics that cropped up. We heard from David Ashford. He was giving us all the headline figures, 1,300 planning approvals for new builds, the OHAN report, making data-driven decisions. Off the back of that, does that give you confidence? What was your take on it?
Those are all good measures. I think those are all good. I think those are all promising, but it's nowhere near enough. And I think that I came in into council a few years back pushing this idea of housing crisis, and it doesn't feel as though the actions we're taking meet the crisis. At the same time, while we're talking about this, government has been really reluctant to spend any money on social housing. They're, in fact, to a large extent, they're looking to cut off taxpayer support for social housing. And one of the consequences of that is it means that a lot of social housing doesn't get built. It looks as to how can you sort of dispose of certain assets that you have? How can you move toward sort of cutting back? How can you look to making cost savings? How can you put more of these costs onto the people who pay the rent? And I think it's one of those where we need to be willing to say, okay, we're going to spend £100 million, we're going to build a lot of social housing, we're going to make rents, social housing rents, sort of self-sustainable, and then go from there, or penalizing certain land use policies that are highly inefficient and just encourage sort of greenfield development. I think it's also one of those, and forgive me for this sort of long rambling answer, is that particularly when you look at the type of housing that we're building, we're also building housing that is going to give us problems in the next 20, 30, 40 years. So when you build American style suburban development purely relying on private developers on greenfield sites, you end up creating a lot of urban infrastructure problems. You end up putting a lot of homes in local authorities that don't always have the capacity to provide services for these homes. You end up building a car-dependent urban sprawl that doesn't have any urban character in itself, and you end up destroying large parts of the sort of natural environment there, which is why we need that sort of joined-up urban thinking with using sort of new urban policies like urban planning principles as a way of driving these policies forward.
We know that there have only been around 339, I think was the figure that was given to me, new builds completed. Not sure how many of those are actually affordable properties or for first-time buyers. But if we're looking at the OHAN report and going on that data, which government says is such a key document, then is the government already quite substantially behind?
It's extremely behind. I mean, we ideally need at least, at minimum, 1,000 social housing units just to cover social housing demand, and then maybe another few thousand social housing units to cover sort of private sector demand. So I think most local authorities, when I speak to the chairs of the local authorities, they seem like they're keen, they seem like they're ready, they seem that they just need the sort of the ability to action it. But I suppose that there's also a concern about the capacity of the construction industry, right? So if we wanted to say today we want to build 10,000 homes the next 10 years or whatever, do we have the capacity in Ireland to build that? And the answer is probably not. So I think it's also about looking at those broader market constraints. And there's ways that we can do that, but that would require a bit of out-the-box thinking and sort of changing what local authorities do and changing what housing providers do. And it feels so at times that a lot of the action that has taken place has been sort of tinkering at the margins. Maybe we establish a housing association, maybe we don't, rather than looking at the fundamental core constraints and listening to housing providers.
Do you think the housing agency, which is proposed, is a step in the right direction?
It's fine, I guess. I have no idea where it's going to go. But at the end of the day, I think whether it's an agency or a part of a department or a housing association is immaterial. And what I kind of want to see is I want to see spades in the ground. So we've got a housing plan, a 10-year housing plan that has been sort of sitting on a shelf for a while waiting for approval and waiting for it to be actioned. And that within itself has 400 housing units that we want to build. And that has been sort of branded as either too ambitious by some within government, but I don't think that it's necessarily ambitious enough in certain areas compared to the scope of need that we have. And I think it's just about rather than sort of shuffling deck chairs on the Titanic, we need to be saying, how do we avoid hitting the iceberg in the first place?
Because when David Ashford says it's crucial that you're not reactive when it comes to housing and that it doesn't just magically appear, would you say enough has been done to plan for the next 20 years?
No. I probably didn't actually intend on this being as critical of the state as it might be coming out. But I think it's one of those where essentially what we need to do is sort of plan that those long-term demographic trends see the housing that we need, because currently the type of housing that we have on Ireland isn't suitable for the population that we have. I mean, that a lot of the housing that we did build were built in times where people had much larger family sizes. Now average occupancy per home is down to about 2.1 people per household, up from like 3.5 a few decades ago. And we need to sort of figure out what these trends are and accommodate that by A, building a lot more apartments in the middle of town on brownfield sites. We need to be helping people downsize because we do have an aging population, building a lot more bungalows that can accommodate people, especially people who do might have mobility issues. And then we do need to create some sort of larger family homes in order to accommodate larger families. Because when population growth does come, or in order to sort of maintain that stable birth rate, you're probably going to have some families that have more than two, have more than three kids. And currently, there isn't much housing for people who are in that state. You could go to the public sector where there is supply constraints. You can go to the private sector where you're spending $2,500, maybe $3,000 a month on a family home. And who conceivably can afford that?
One of the big talking points over the course of this administration, which will be very much in your mind, is rates, or rather a lack of, on dilapidated and ruinous buildings. You're a big fan of that, aren't you?
Yeah. No, I'm less a fan of dilapidated properties. Despite the rumours. No, but I'm a big fan of the idea of, A, you change behaviour by changing incentives. And by putting rates on dilapidated properties, you can't just land bank a property now. You can't just buy a property if you're a UK buyer and just leave it for a very long period of time. You now have an incentive to actually do something with it because this asset is not costing you money. And that might be, A, getting it redeveloped, B, moving it on, or C, sort of forming some sort of public-private partnership or working with other sort of private developers. But I don't think that it goes far enough, because this is step one of many. And the next step, ideally, would be seeing a vacancy rate or additional vacancy charge on empty properties, and then also maybe having a multiplier for empty properties owned by people who don't live on the Isle of Man. I think it's fundamentally wrong that if you're a family and you're looking to purchase a home, that you get outbidded or are competed by foreign investors who don't necessarily live here. And it's probably one of the reasons why we can see that the big sort of housing construction that we have seen hasn't actually lessened prices at all, because if they're all sold to UK buyers under the idea that, well, the Isle of Man doesn't have any stamp duty, then we're fundamentally not building houses for people, we're building houses for the sake of investment.
Do you think there could be any potential for loopholes, though? I put this question to David Ashford, that if people were to choose to demolish their houses instead of bring them back onto the market. Obviously, a demolished house means no rates anyway. He says that obviously people have to apply to demolish, and putting "I don't want to pay rates" as the reason for demolition won't be sufficient. But people won't write that, will they?
Yeah. There are certain ways around it. So there's two approaches you could go on. A, you could sort of put a rates or charge on dilapidated or vacant brownfield sites, and these litter Douglas. It's one of the reasons why Douglas doesn't look as attractive as many of the other towns that we have on the Isle of Man, is because you've got a lot of vacant brownfield sites. So there should be a charge for that. If you're leaving productive land unused, you could probably pay a rate on that, probably equivalent to some percentage of what the building was when it did exist. And then secondly, what you could do is you could go the more Georgist sort of land value tax route, which is evaluating rates on the basis of the underlying land value beneath them. And what that also does, that solves several problems, is that it also encourages a certain amount of urban density and productive use of land within urban cores. It ends up charging agricultural land lower rates, but that is a much larger sort of set of reforms. But land value tax and sort of a more Georgist way of thinking about sort of land pricing, rather than our sort of hodgepodge rate system that was sort of envisaged about 70 years ago.
And what would that do for Douglas Council if the proposals that they have set out at the moment, that dilapidated and ruinous buildings would be required to pay rates? What would that do for the council? Is that a big income spike?
It wouldn't be a massive income spike. I mean, it would probably be in the order of a percent or two. But essentially what that would do is it's also fundamentally about fairness. If you're a hardworking tenant or homeowner, and you pay your rates, and someone owns five or six properties, and two of those are dilapidated, and you're essentially paying their rates for them, I think you have to ask yourselves, is this fundamentally fair in a small sort of island community where we all know each other? And the answer that I would have there is probably not, right? And I think, secondly, what you'd end up seeing is the main benefit is bringing these buildings back into use. Because a building isn't just a building. It's a home. It's a business. It's a place where people do work. It's a place where people sort of socialize. And by bringing a vacant property back into use, then you end up creating activity. Because a town isn't just a collection of buildings or infrastructure. It's also a place where people do things. And that's what we want to see, is we want to see these buildings brought back into use fundamentally. One of the core issues that we have is when you look down Strand Street, you look at the High Street, is one of the biggest cost pressures on small businesses is a high cost of rent. And if you're a large sort of commercial property owner, what you can do is you can say, well, I'm holding out for the £100,000 I might get for this sort of small shop. And there needs to be an incentive against that sort of land hoarding. You should just be putting it back into use, property ownership, especially on sort of core commercial sites like that, that there are these community hubs, should also come with some responsibilities attached to them.
And just final thoughts, we'll look ahead to the next 12 months. We obviously have an election, but we also have a government saying that there are tough decisions to be made. Is that a realistic approach? Because in any election year, tough decisions never tend to be at the forefront of any politician's mind. Mm-hmm.
I suppose that Tynwald itself is fractious, right? I mean, I think everyone is looking for someone to hold the can at the end of this. And I'm sure that tough choice is always going to be part of it. But I think that at any position of public responsibility, you do have tough choices. And one thing I would like to say is I've got the utmost respect for people who do decide to put themselves in the limelight and do decide to put themselves in that tough decision. I mean, being a Tynwald member doesn't pay. It does pay well, but it doesn't pay as much as what a lot of these folks could be earning perhaps in the private sector, and they take an immense amount of abuse for what they do, and they also work extremely hard, many of them do, and I do sympathize with the sort of decision that they have to be in, and I don't envy them for one second.
You take a lot of abuse on social media as well, though.
Yeah, but I probably deserve it, right? I mean, I think I give out as much as I get. So, I mean, I feel like it's good. I like to be in the mix. I've always come from that sort of political culture where it's quite nice to just get involved.
Would you ever consider standing? I know that's probably maybe you've been asked that before.
I'm far too shy. I'm far too shy. Could I be involved in sort of national politics? I don't know. I think the one thing that might, I mean, obviously it comes down to what happens at the time, but I think I've made a commitment to Douglas. And what I would like to do is sort of get these plans set up and established. But
so you're not ruling out entirely, but for now you're happy with being leader of Douglas Council.
I feel like it's nice to keep people on their toes, right? I mean, I mean, why wouldn't we want to have that speculation out there?
So a true politician's answer. We haven't got an answer.
Yeah, that's exactly it, right? I mean, I feel like it's worth preparing to sort of provide sort of politician's answers. But I think it's one of those where, for a long time, a lot of people have characterized local government as being a stepping stone into national government. And I think that that's a sort of an assumption that I would like to try and challenge, is the fact that the sort of decisions you make on a local level are in fact sometimes more impactful. They have a really big impact on people's day-to-day lives. And I know that we're going to be putting in plans to, we've tried to look at some sort of creative financing institutions to sort of build another block of housing. And that wouldn't come without constant work and pushing by members. And I know that long after I'm not here anymore, my grandkids and my great-grandkids will be able to maybe live in a block of apartments that I've helped build. And that is such a meaningful, such an impactful thing. And I think that's a sort of set of decisions that if you're looking to be involved in public service, carry a massive weight in them in themselves. I think that we need to start really thinking about politics as being about people and more about what we want to achieve. And what I see is an island where the economy is so vastly unequal, and so many people suffer in either hunger or homelessness, and that's just fundamentally immoral, and that's not correct. And any way that we have to sort of slow that down and push back against that, I'd encourage anyone to stand and run.
Thank you for making it to the end of the Manx Radio newscast. You are obviously someone with exquisite taste. May I politely suggest you might want to subscribe to this and a wide range of Manx Radio podcasts at your favourite podcast provider, so our best bits will magically appear on your smartphone. Thank you.